Neolithic people already had the mutation. People with a lactase mutation must have started the dairy economy. If the opposite is true, that the Neolithic people did not have the mutation, we can conclude that the selective pressure from the dairy economy triggered the increase in frequency of the genetic mutation. In 2007, researchers from the Gutenberg University in Germany and University College London in Great Britain succeeded in extracting ancient DNA from a Neolithic skeleton dated to before the advent of the dairy economy. Ancient DNA that is extracted from a fossil is extremely difficult to isolate because of the fragmentation and contamination of the sample. Yet, thanks to recent advances in genetics, even such ancient genomic data can be extracted with high reliability. Analysis of the ancient DNA extracted from the Neolithic skeleton showed that it did not have the mutation to digest lactase. Therefore, our lactase mutation started to increase in frequency only within the last 10,000 years, after the start of the dairy economy. Why did milk drinkers increase? The data support the hypothesis that the lactase mutation was an adaptation to the dairy economy and pastoralism. This mutation, present only within the last 10,000 years, is an extremely recent development from the perspective of human evolutionary history. Yet in some populations, the mutation's frequency is already as high as 90%. Why has the recent selective pressure to digest milk been so strong? Such speedy dispersal of a mutation means that the people with that particular mutation have been leaving significantly more offspring in the next generation than those without the mutation. In other words, people who could not drink milk either died younger or were not as reproductively successful as people who could. What could be so critically important about milk that it became a matter of life and death? Several hypotheses address this question. The first is that drinking milk makes people taller, which may have been a significant advantage. Indeed, Northern Europeans are considered some of the tallest people in the world, and they drink a lot of milk. But it is not clear that they are tall because they drink milk. No study has clearly shown which compound in milk increases height and weight through which chemical process. Furthermore, it has not been clarified how being tall could be a selectively advantageous morphological trait. Another argument is that milk provides valuable calcium and protein. But calcium and protein can also be acquired through cheese or yogurt, which are easier to digest than milk because of the way lactose is transformed through the fermentation process. Why would a human population wait around for a genetic mutation when an easier and more immediate pathway of adaptation is possible through culture? In fact, many cultures in the Middle East have dairy economies, but the proportion of adults who can digest milk is lower than in Northern Europe. It is possible that the lower frequency of milk digesting enzymes in Middle Eastern populations is due to ingesting milk in a form that is easier on the system, such as cheese or yogurt. One final hypothesis is that milk provides vitamin D, an important component for absorbing calcium in the body. It is also the only vitamin that we can synthesize on our own from sunlight. Since there is not much sunlight in Northern Europe, the vitamin D hypothesis is convincing. This argument, however, is less convincing when we consider other regions where mutations for lactose digestion are also prevalent, such as Sudan. In conclusion, the mystery continues. We still don't know why milk has had life or death importance on our development. Yet we can still enjoy milk and ice cream without understanding why. Coevolution of humans and cows. In the last 10,000 years, humans evolved the ability to drink milk into adulthood from a series of genetic mutations in the lactase gene. But it is not just humans who underwent big evolutionary changes. Milk itself has changed, because the genetic makeup of the cows that produce the milk has changed through domestication. Just as the rice we eat today tastes quite different from wild rice, milk from domesticated cows is quite different from wild milk. Milk also underwent changes to fit the taste buds of humans, to be more like human breast milk. We have changed cow milk to fit our own tastes. Through animal husbandry and artificial selection, We have altered cows' genes to suit us. Some people argue that it's harmful to feed human babies cow milk. But perhaps it is the calves instead that should be protesting about the strange-tasting milk, fit to feed humans, that they have to drink. From the 1960s until just a few years ago, scientists thought we had stopped evolving after the Neolithic Age, when agricultural civilization started. We thought our bodies were remnants of an era before 10,000 years ago. Instead, genetics and anthropology have shown that humans have continued to evolve recently, at an even faster rate than we did over the previous 5 million years. I'll revisit this idea in Chapter 22. Extra. Got milk?
The Got Milk advertising campaign featured famous stars such as Hugh Jackman from the X-Men movies and the popular singer Rihanna.
These advertisements made it look like it was only natural to drink milk as adults. But, just as in the rest of the world, a lot of adults in the United States cannot digest milk. From the 16th to 18th centuries, and then again in the mid-19th century, waves of immigrants from Northern Europe brought the dairy economy with them. As explained in this chapter, these people had the mutation to digest milk into adulthood. As they became identified with mainstream culture, drinking milk as adults also came to be considered normal. Not being able to digest milk became rather provincial. It was not too long ago, only in the late 19th to early 20th centuries, that milk came to be considered an essential part of the American diet. The interesting thing is that drinking milk is going global. Like McDonald's and Starbucks, drinking milk is perceived to be part of a development or westernization package. In the 1990s, the two countries that showed the biggest increase in milk consumption were China and India. Yet, both China and India have a high proportion of adults who cannot digest milk. Considering that both of these cultures boast a diverse cuisine rich in all necessary nutrients, it is hard to believe that the motivation to drink milk as adults lies purely in the nutritional benefit of milk drinking. Chapter 7. A Gene for Snow White. Every summer, a wave of new beauty products promise to make our skin lighter. Do they work? Can we make our skin white? Not really. We are born with our skin color, which is derived from a particular combination of genes coding for the skin pigment melanin. Although sunlight and exposure play a role in determining skin color, sunlight, or lack thereof, cannot completely change the skin color we are born with. This simple fact, the amount of melanin in our skin, has been the source of many sensitive and controversial debates throughout human history. Surprisingly, though, it was only in the 17th century that skin color began to be used by Europeans to classify humans into different races, of black, white, yellow, and red. As they circumnavigated the world, Europeans encountered people who looked dramatically different from themselves, with different skin color. Beginning in the 1960s, however, anthropologists started to question this fact of racial difference. Biological anthropologists such as C. Loring Brace and Frank Livingstone, both at the University of Michigan, argued at that time that skin color was not a fundamental and fixed characteristic that could be used to demarcate racial categories. As mentioned already, skin color can change to a degree, depending on exposure to ultraviolet sunlight. In an article published in 1962 with the title On the Non-Existence of Human Races, Livingstone left this famous quote, "There are no races. There are only clines." If you look at a world map, you can see that there is some relationship between the strength of ultraviolet radiation in different regions and the skin color of the people who live in those regions. Those who live in regions with a lot of UV radiation tend to have darker skin, and those living in regions with less UV radiation tend to have lighter skin. And there is a continuum of skin color between black and white, a gradation of all the other supposed skin color categories. Skin color is nothing more than the result of adaptation to a specific environmental condition, not an inherent and essential trait that can be used to define racial categories. Furthermore, it has become well established that race is not a biologically meaningful category along any human trait. It's a social construct. It looks as if there is no need for any more debate about skin color. Yet, this conclusion is only the beginning of a series of complex questions about the mysterious nature of skin color. Humans have peach fuzz. Mammals have fur that protects their bodies. Fur keeps dangerous things away, such as ultraviolet radiation, thorns, fangs, and other elements of nature. Fur maintains a stable body temperature by keeping the layer of air around the body warm or cool. Thanks to fur, mammals have the ability to survive in a wide range of environments, regardless of the temperature. Given all the advantages of fur, human skin is very strange. We are covered not with fur, but with hair, a rare trait among mammals. The only other mammals without fur either have been selectively bred that way, or live in environments that lack sun exposure. Among mammals who live above ground and are regularly exposed to sunlight, humans are uniquely naked. Compared to other animals of similar body size, however, humans do have a similar number of pores and a similar number of hair follicles covering their bodies. We just appear naked because our hair is short and fine, akin to a light-colored peach fuzz. Humans have become naked not by losing their fur, per se, but by changing the kind of fur they had. When did this transformation happen? And why? The most convincing hypothesis has to do with our ability to eat large amounts of meat. Early hominins were probably fruit-eating vegetarians, but that changed about 2.5 million years ago. Although all they could get was scraps of meat and marrow left behind after other animals had taken their meals from a carcass, there was still enough meat to fuel an increase in brain and body size, ultimately leading to more sophisticated stone tool technology for hunting. Mammals with fur usually hunt during the evening, in the early morning, or at night, when the temperature drops. Think of a lion on the African savanna, with its mane and lustrous fur. A male lion or lioness sure looks beautiful, but could he or she run around in the middle of a hot day? It would be like me trying to run around the savannah in a long fur coat. I would likely collapse from a heat stroke, and for a lion it's much worse. Moreover, in the middle of a hot day, despite the shade, predators often open their mouths and pant to dissipate extra body heat, just like a dog does on a hot summer day. For furry mammals, even remaining perfectly still in the midday heat is exhausting, never mind running after a gazelle galloping away at 40 miles per hour. Hominins seized the opportunity and became hunters during the day when other predators were resting. But this change would have been impossible with a body covered with fur. How were early hominins able to shed their fur coats? Birth of the naked human and dark skin. Suppose a mutation leading to extreme hair reduction and nakedness appeared accidentally. Hominins with this mutation would have been able to conquer the hot days in Africa by getting rid of extra body heat through the evaporation of sweat on their naked skin. Not all traits are purely advantageous. Going furless came with a cost. Once hominins began to regulate their body temperature through sweating, they became that much more dependent on adequate water sources. It must have been difficult to find drinking water in Africa during its dry seasons. Where and when to get water would have been critically important information, so it became essential for early hominins to store this seasonal knowledge in their memory and to communicate that knowledge to the next generation. Moreover, frequent visits to the same waterhole are dangerous, so an ability to effectively communicate those dangers became important. Ultraviolet radiation would also have been a problem for our furless ancestors. Without the fur that blocked it, hominin skin was directly exposed to UV radiation, which can cause severe burns and lead to infections. But more important, from an evolutionary perspective, UV radiation can also induce birth defects by destroying folic acid in the body. Extensive sun exposure has the potential to reduce the number of viable offspring. This selective pressure would lead to an adaptation to block the sun's radiation. In the human body, this function is performed by melanin, the chemical protein for skin pigment. Melanin is produced by specialized cells in the human body called melanocytes. The more melanin is produced, the darker the skin becomes. This is precisely why we think the first furless hominins in Africa had darker skin. After exchanging fur for sweat, ancestral humans had to adopt darker skin to survive. In contrast, animals with dark fur, like chimpanzees, tend to have lighter or white skin. Because fur blocks sunlight, there is no need for the underlying skin to be pigmented, and therefore no reason to have skin color. Following this logic, the first humans with naked skin must have quickly developed darker skin, and all humans must belong to the black race. But not everyone in the world has dark skin. In fact, some people's skin is almost white. So, how did so many Snow Whites come about in human history? We got back lighter skin. As modern humans spread all over the world, they moved from equatorial regions to more northern regions with less sunlight. In particular, the time when hominins spread far and wide was during the repeated cycle of glacial and interglacial periods of the Ice Age. During the glacial periods, the frequency of cloudy days increased, and there was not as much sunlight. The reduction in direct sunlight meant there was less UV radiation to block, so humans did not need as much melanin. By itself, however, this change should not have been enough to trigger whiter skin. Not needing melanin is not the same as needing lighter skin. If melanin was completely irrelevant to survival, it would not matter if our skin was dark or pale. It turns out that skin color is not a mere elective. It is critically important for nutrient regulation. In the case of folic acid, in fact, skin color could be a matter of life or death. In the same way that you need more melanin to survive in a region of strong sunlight, you also need less melanin to survive in a region of weak sunlight. Why? Because our bodies need some UV radiation to synthesize a very important vitamin, D. Vitamin D plays a critical role in calcium metabolism and nutrient absorption. Without it, our bones lose their rigidity and become deformed because calcium cannot be absorbed properly. If adults go without vitamin D for a prolonged period of time, or if growing children experience vitamin D deficiency during their growth periods, they can develop rickets or other harmful conditions. A deformed bone does not necessarily mean death. For women of reproductive age, however, bone deformity can certainly present a life or death situation. Specifically, a deformity of the pelvis would have a devastating effect on a mother's childbirth prospects. In the face of such a clear reproductive threat for mothers and babies, humanity adapted by having lighter skin to better synthesize vitamin D in more northern regions. The world map of skin color shows that skin color is gradually distributed, with the gradations aligned by latitude. Darker skin is found in the equatorial region, and lighter skin away from the equator, as predicted by the vitamin D hypothesis of skin color. The reason for the gradation is that annual solar radiation varies by distance from the equator, with more radiation around the equator and less radiation farther from the equator. The genes for skin color were discovered only recently. The first such gene, one responsible for melanin production, was reported in 1999. Since then, at least 12 other genes involved in skin color have been discovered. Different combinations of these different genes result in the variation of skin color. Some genes are regulatory. They turn on or turn off the gene that makes melanin. Snow White, from the famous 19th century German fairy tale, probably had such white skin because she had one of the genes that turned off the melanin-producing gene. Even though the geographic distribution of dark and light skin tones is consistent by latitude, the frequency of each of these specific genes varies by continent. For example, while Polynesians, who live in the Western Pacific, and Equatorial Africans both have dark skin tones, those tones are different, on average, in color and brightness. Moreover, different genes are responsible for the lighter skin of Northern Europeans versus the lighter skin of Northeastern Asians. Even at the same latitude, skin color differs in a variety of ways, depending on how long the population has been living in that region and how much vitamin D is incorporated into the everyday diet. In 2015, David Reich and his team at Harvard University published interesting research about differing skin tones. In a surprising discovery, it turns out the light skin of Europeans has been around for less than 5,000 years. This seems almost impossible. Ancestral humans, upon leaving Africa, had to live in Europe during the Ice Age. Surely, With critically low levels of UV radiation at that time, they should have lost the melanin coloring that would have prevented adequate vitamin D synthesis. The mutation for white skin therefore should have originated at least several hundred thousand years ago, if not a million years ago or more, since this is when ancestral humans first started to live in Europe. And from there, the mutation should have spread all over the world. Perhaps modern humans left Africa only recently, and then migrated to Europe? Even in this more conservative scenario, the lighter skin mutation should have appeared at least several tens of thousands of years ago in Neanderthals. 5,000 years is quite unexpectedly recent. What could have happened? One hypothesis that is gaining traction suggests that this recent appearance has to do with agriculture and a sedentary lifestyle. Before agriculture, there was not as much need for us to synthesize vitamin D, even in areas with deficient UV radiation. Why? Because our everyday diet had a sufficient amount of vitamin D in the plants, marine sources, and meat we consumed. As we shifted to sedentary agriculture as our main source of subsistence, however, we increasingly relied on processed grains and starches, which were deficient in many nutrients, including vitamin D. With vitamin D through food no longer a viable solution, a mutation that caused the melanocytes, melanin-making cells, to become less active became advantageous. Less active melanocytes resulted in lighter skin, allowing for vitamin D synthesis even with a small amount of direct sunlight. Extra. Complete block is not the answer. For a while now in the United States and Europe, tanning salons have been quite popular. As more research has been released showing that UV radiation is harmful to health, however, sunscreen use has gained popularity as sun lovers have started to worry about getting skin cancer. We've now become so good at using sunscreen, though, that its overuse is turning into a problem. Since 2000, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has warned against the dangers of vitamin D deficiency brought on by the use of too much sunblock and not enough sun exposure. The CDC has also suggested that we start to add foods rich in vitamin D to our diets, such as milk and eggs. We know that too much of a good thing can be bad, but we need to be careful about where we draw the line. Chapter 8. Granny is an Artist. For most of human history, having a long life has been considered a blessing. Traditionally, not many people lived to be old. For example, until the first half of the 20th century in Korea, a 60th birthday was a rare enough event that entire villages would turn out to celebrate. But only one generation later, barely 20 years, such large-scale 60th birthday parties had become rare. Instead, many had moved the big celebration back to their 70th birthday. Nowadays, fewer and fewer people throw a big 70th birthday bash. People seem to be growing accustomed to their newfound longevity, waiting and looking forward to easily reaching a lifespan of 100 years or more. But to tell the truth, the outlook is not as optimistic as you might think. Long life also turns out to be a great source of anxiety. At the forefront of this anxiety is the emerging group of senior citizens who are increasingly frail. In our hearts, even though we are living longer, we know that we will not be as healthy in old age as we were when we were young. When we turn 99, let's party like it's 1999, does not fill us with a sense of delightful hope. It sounds more like a desperate plea, because we know we'll inevitably be fragile at the end of such a long life. And the anxiety about growing old goes beyond our individual health. It has socioeconomic implications as well. This is why there's so much debate over Medicare and Social Security benefits. With all the perceived drawbacks of aging, you might wonder why we ever evolved to grow older in the first place. Or are we missing another viewpoint on human longevity? The rise of longevity. In part, longevity has increased because advances in modern medicine have helped reduce mortality rates. As recently as the beginning of the 20th century, both fertility and mortality rates were relatively high. Many people were born and many died before reaching old age, making the average lifespan quite short. By the middle of the 20th century, mortality had decreased as fewer people were dying, thanks to advances in modern medicine. Infant mortality, however, remained high. Many newborns died after only a few months. In traditional Korean culture, people refrained from congratulating pregnant women and even refrained from celebrating the birth. Instead, many families would wait until children were 3 months old to celebrate their birth in a ceremony called the Paegil, which means 100 days. Such postponement of the celebration of birth can be found historically in many cultures and societies around the world, including Nigeria, Japan, Tonga, and Hawaii, where the first, third, or fifth birthday is a cause for a great celebration, rather than the day of birth. The reason for delaying the celebration of birth was that until recently, many children were not expected to live past their first birthday. In fact, life goes through a series of mortality risks. Mortality increases around the time of weaning, regardless of when that happens, which can vary across different cultures. Increased reliance on food sources besides breast milk introduces children to a whole host of foodborne illnesses that can easily lead to diseases. Even after surviving this risky initial period of solid food consumption, however, mortality increases again around 16 to 18 years of age, defined as the completion of somatic growth, growth of the body. After this time, young women face higher mortality due to risks associated with pregnancy and childbirth, while young men face higher mortality due to accidents. Middle-aged adults see yet another peak in mortality, this time due to diseases rather than accidents. People go through numerous peaks and valleys of mortality risk throughout life. The increased average lifespan in contemporary times means that more people survive these risks of death. There are fewer accidents and wars. More diseases are treatable. Fewer deaths result from complications of pregnancy and childbirth. And so on. With these obstacles to longevity minimized, but a high fertility rate persisting, the population had exploded by the end of the 20th century. But then, people in industrialized countries began to have fewer children. After all, the likelihood that the children they did have would reach adulthood had greatly increased. So now, for the first time in human history, most developed countries are experiencing extremely low fertility and extremely low mortality. As a result, we are presented with a new phenomenon, an increasing size of the elderly population. When we look at it this way, the longevity of humans appears to be a direct result of technological advances. As we're about to see, however, our longevity did not increase just because of modern civilization. In fact, the number of elderly humans, specifically the number of grandparents, increased long before settled societies even started. Furthermore, we know that longevity is somewhat heritable. Long-lived people tend to come from families of long-lived people. In fact, several specific genes, which had gone unnoticed until recently, are known to contribute to longevity. Could this mean that longevity actually has an evolutionary advantage? Intuitively, longevity doesn't seem to be clearly advantageous. For a feature to have an evolutionary advantage, it should contribute to leaving offspring behind. In other words, it should be advantageous for reproduction. Human females experience menopause, or reproductive senescence, around the age of 50. Natural ovulatory cycles cease, and pregnancy with childbirth is no longer possible. Considering that evolutionary success is defined by reproductive success, there seems to be no evolutionary point to living long after menopause, since pregnancy and childbirth are no longer possible. Most females in the animal world remain reproductive until the end of their lives. The few that do reach menopause die shortly thereafter. In contrast, human females live an active, healthy life for at least 10 to 15 years after menopause. Given that the life expectancy in 2017 for Korean women is 90, women there may expect to live for 40 more years after menopause. From the perspective of an average mammalian lifespan, this is a truly remarkable situation. To solve the mystery of human longevity, anthropologist Kirsten Hawkes of the University of Utah proposed in 1989 the grandmother hypothesis. According to this hypothesis, the elderly, specifically postmenopausal women, help with the survival of their genes not by giving birth themselves, but by helping to take care of the youngest members of their family. Through this mechanism, grandparents in particular are able to ensure the survival of their genes into later generations. Selection would favor grandmothers who have long, healthy lives past reproductive age. When did longevity begin? With sapiens or erectus? When did longevity first appear in human history? One recurring lesson in studying evolutionary history is that what seems to be a natural, obvious phenomenon is often the result of a long, meandering process. Such is the case with longevity. Proponents of the grandmother hypothesis argued that longevity first appeared 2 million years ago, with Homo erectus. The pillars of their argument were brain and body size. The bigger brains and larger bodies that set Homo erectus apart from previous hominins indicated a slow and lengthy aging process. It was argued that the bigger brain and larger body were attained by delayed maturation. Maintaining a growth rate during development for a longer period of time will, of course, result in greater size. And if the growth rate for some parts of the body slows while the growth rate for other parts stays the same, those other parts will get even bigger. This slower and longer growth process was mirrored in old age as a slow and lengthy aging process. If the grandmother hypothesis does indeed apply to Homo erectus, its aging process needed to be slow in order to maintain an active and energetic post-reproductive phase. As great as the grandmother hypothesis sounded in theory, it had a significant problem. It could not easily be tested using archaeological data or contemporary populations. One study showed that grandmothers were associated with decreased infant mortality. Another did not. One computer simulation showed that grandmothering could not lead to longevity. Another showed that it could. Some researchers have tried using osteological evidence, skeletal remains, from Homo erectus to estimate the age of death. But this task turns out to be very difficult with adult specimens. It is relatively easy to estimate the age of individuals who did not complete their growth, because changes in bones and teeth are age-specific during the growth period. After puberty, however, there are no significant changes in bones or teeth that can be tied with specific ages. Moreover, there is so much individual variation in the aging process that assessing age is tricky with older individuals. For example, arthritis can be recognized in bones, but the same degree of osteoarthritis can be found in people in their 30s or in their 50s. So all one can say with accuracy is 30-plus years of age. These constraints present a serious challenge for testing the grandmother hypothesis through the fossil record. Working with anthropologist Rachel Kaspari of Central Michigan University, I decided to attack this problem from a new angle. If age assessment of adults can never be accurate enough to test the grandmother hypothesis directly, why not choose an indirect route? Instead of agonizing over accurate age estimation, we divided hominin fossil specimens into young adults and old adults. We defined young adults as any specimens that completed the growth process and had a potential of reproduction, which is biologically marked by the appearance of the third molar, wisdom tooth. We defined old adults as those who had a potential to be a grandparent, and were at least twice as old as the youngest of the young adults. We inferred twice as old from the degree of wear on the teeth, modifying the Miles method of age estimation developed in the 1960s. For instance, let's assume that the third molar appears at the age of 18 on average, marking the initiation of young adulthood. A young adult who then began to have children would potentially be a grandparent around the age of 36, when their oldest children would be turning 18 and having children of their own. This is why we defined an old adult as someone with twice the wear, and therefore potentially twice the age, of a young adult. If it was impossible to come up with an accurate age at death for adults, insisting on some specific age with an unknown error range would erode the credibility of the research. Instead, we settled on a categorical approach that fit the characteristics of the data better. We collected data from all hominin fossil remains that could be assessed using our old and young metrics, a total of 768 individuals. The data came from specimens that included Australopithecines, belonging to the genus Australopithecus, Homo erectus, Neanderthals, and the European Upper Paleolithic Homo sapiens. We calculated the ratio of old adults and young adults, named the OY ratio for each group, to see whether it changed over different times and across different groups. A ratio of 1 to 1 meant there was an equal number of old adults and young adults. A ratio larger than 1 to 1 meant more old adults compared to young adults, and a ratio smaller than 1 to 1 meant more young adults. As we expected, the OI ratio increased over time from the Australopithecines on. The OI ratio for Homo erectus, starting 2 million years ago, was higher than that of the Australopithecines, starting 4 million years ago. And the ratio in Neanderthals, starting 200,000 years ago, was higher than in either of the other two groups. Our data revealed a surprise, though. The greatest degree of increase in the ratio, which can be called the first appearance of longevity, did not coincide with the appearance of Homo erectus. It was associated with the European Upper Paleolithic Homo sapiens, starting about 30,000 years ago. Before this time, the OI ratio, even though it was increasing, never rose above 1 to 1. From the Australopithecines until the Neanderthals, there were still more young adults than old adults. The Homo sapiens sample, however, exhibited an OI ratio of more than 2 to 1. There were twice as many old adults as young adults. The increase was explosive. Considering that the Upper European Paleolithic period also marked an increase in burials, we wondered whether the burial cases could have biased the data, so we redid the analysis without data from burials. But the results were the same. The OI ratio in Upper European Paleolithic Homo sapiens was more than 2 to 1, representing a big increase from earlier time periods. The advent of grandparents and human longevity appears to have occurred during Upper Paleolithic culture, only 30,000 years ago, not with Homo erectus nearly 2 million years ago. Longevity and the blossoming of art. Interestingly, the Upper Paleolithic culture, the culture of anatomically modern Homo sapiens, is considered revolutionarily different from previous cultures. Artistic and symbolic expressions, as seen in cave art and ornaments, began to flourish in this period. Was it a simple coincidence that this period also saw an explosive increase in longevity? Might there be a causal relationship between art and longevity? Art and symbols are associated with more abstract thinking, and they also perform a practical function, the transmission of cultural information and meaning. The increased use of art and symbols during the Upper Paleolithic reflects the increasing importance of knowledge transmission. Intriguingly, longevity also contributes to increased knowledge transmission. Living long enough to see grandchildren meant that three generations could exist at the same time, so people could archive and share knowledge between generations for a longer period of time than earlier hominins could. If we assume 25 years for a single generation, and two generations share 50 years, then three generations can share 75 years worth of cultural memory. Thus, longevity provided an actual mechanism for increased information production, sharing, and retention. As a consequence, it could very well have played a role in the birth of art and meaningful symbols. Despite our increasing lifespan, this overlapping of just three generations does not seem to have changed much since the Upper Paleolithic. When the average life expectancy was barely 60 years, as was the case in the late 1970s for the world average, grandparents survived until their grandchildren grew up, leading to three generations living together at the same time. Since then, life expectancy has skyrocketed for some populations, as high as 90 for Korean women. Doesn't this mean there should be an increase in the number of great-grandparents who survive until their great-grandchildren reach adulthood? In other words, shouldn't there be an increasing number of cases of four generations coexisting? Instead, there are fewer people at the age of 60 who have grandchildren, let alone great-grandchildren, than there were a couple of generations ago, even though many are now living past 70 years of age. What happened? It appears that young couples are delaying marriage and reproduction longer than ever before in our history. As a result, while a life expectancy of 100 years may be right in front of our eyes, we have preserved the Upper Paleolithic family structure of just three generations in coexistence, not four. Perhaps it is not that we're living longer than in previous times, but rather that we're just living more slowly. The age of a slow life is indeed upon us. Extra. How long can you live? Although we are about to enter the age of centenarians, 100-year-olds, it doesn't mean that our average maximum lifespan is longer. We call that our absolute lifespan. In other words, our possible lifespan in the absence of accidents or diseases, determined only by our aging process. No matter how much modern medicine advances, our absolute lifespan has an upper threshold. How long is an average human's absolute lifespan? Although we do not know for sure, we hypothesize that it should be approximately the same as the median of the longest recorded lifespans. Currently, the oldest person on record is Jean Calment, 1875 to 1997, who died at the age of 122. Furthermore, the top 100 individuals holding the longest lifespans recorded are all concentrated at about 114 to 119 years of age. Among these people, only 8 have a chance at setting a new record of longevity. This seems to be indirect evidence that absolute lifespan does not increase, no matter how many advances are made in modern medicine. The era of centenarians does not refer to increased maximum lifespan, but rather to increased survivorship of adults into old age. Chapter 9. Did farming bring prosperity? In many parts of the world, agriculture has long meant prosperity. In Korea, agriculture and farmers were traditionally considered the foundation of the world and were held in high regard. After foraging for natural resources for several million years, humans started about 10,000 to 11,000 years ago to systematically grow plants and domesticate animals on a large scale to produce food for themselves. In retrospect, this seems to have been the dawn of prosperity for humanity. If primitive societies had to wander around all day to get the minimum amount of food necessary to keep living until tomorrow, farmers, by contrast, seemed to enjoy a rich lifestyle, working just a little and harvesting a lot. Without needing to do so much work, humans began to have leisure time. Without having to move around looking for food, humans began to live together in one place. With agriculture, we could expect to look forward to enjoying a long life, with a disease-free, healthy body, living with family and friends in the brilliant civilizations that began to blossom. Or so we thought. Anthropological and archaeological research spanning the last 50 years has brought to question what we believed about the impact of agriculture on the human body and society. Farming is unhealthy. To study life before agriculture, anthropologists lived together for several years with modern-day primitive societies that do not farm, conducting what is called ethnographic research. The most prominent example is the Harvard Kalahari Project, involving several different teams living in Africa between 1950 and 1979. Admittedly, the exposure sometimes resulted in an unfortunately simplistic, misleading, and racist picture of the Kalahari people, better known as the San or Kong. For example, the movie The Gods Must Be Crazy, 1980, is a comedy premised on the discovery of a Coca-Cola bottle by these bushmen. Continuous accumulation of solid research, however, led to an in-depth understanding of the hunter-gatherer cultures of the Kong and brought to light surprising facts about their life, which was rich and decidedly not primitive or savage. Although they could not afford to lead a completely work-free life, the Kong had substantial leisure time. They were not roaming around all day, half-starved, nor were they subject to widespread famine or infectious diseases. The absence of agriculture did not make life brutal and difficult. Does this mean, then, that an already rich hunter-gatherer lifestyle just got richer with agriculture? No, not really. Instead, studies of human skeletal remains revealed that once healthy people became vulnerable to many diseases and malnutrition only after they adopted agriculture. Human skeletons and teeth tell us a lot about a person's childhood, life, and ailments. Without sufficient nutrition in the early years, normal growth patterns are interrupted, leaving a signature on the bones and teeth. Enamel hypoplasia is a well-known example of this type of signature. The condition is caused by a deformity in the enamel of permanent teeth from malnutrition during childhood. Since permanent teeth are made once in a person's lifetime, the signs of nutritional ailments that occurred during childhood remain permanently etched in those teeth. Anthropologists discovered that the frequency of enamel hypoplasia increased conspicuously when a population adopted agriculture, suggesting that adopting agriculture led to severe malnutrition in a population. Similarly, measurements of limb bones, arm bones or leg bones, show that those of agriculturally based populations were shorter. With the advent of agriculture, people became shorter than their predecessors because of bouts of famine and severe malnutrition. These findings show how erroneous it is to assume that agriculture brought a rich and prosperous lifestyle. In fact, the malnutrition that has accompanied agricultural lifestyles in the past can even be seen today. Have you seen pictures of malnourished young children with swollen stomachs? This symptom is a sign of a disease called kwashiorkor. Contrary to what you might expect, this disease is not caused by a deficiency in caloric intake. Instead, the cause is insufficient protein intake, even when overall caloric intake is sufficient. In other words, you can get this condition if you eat only nutritionally deficient foods, starches or processed empty carbs, every day. Left untreated, this disease can be fatal. Ironically, overall malnutrition, where total intake, not just protein intake, is deficient, is less dangerous to the human body. Why are there health risks when we produce food directly from the land? In some ways, agriculture is similar to an investment plan that focuses on stocks from just one or two companies, rather than a diversified portfolio. If the weather and soil is good, the return on farming investment is large, and everyone can have a feast. If the weather is unfavorable, however, the harvest for the whole year can be ruined, and everyone will be starving the following year. In contrast, with the foraging economy before agriculture, we acquired food from a broad territory and a diverse range of sources. Even when one particular food item had run out, there were many alternatives. To be sure, feasts were rare, but so were famines. Humans clearly did not eat better after adopting agriculture. To make matters worse, diseases also increased and ran rampant among early agricultural societies. Take dental cavities and gum diseases, for example. In many agricultural societies, water is added to the staple grain, which is then cooked, much like rice or pasta, to become a soft cereal. A diet like that has a higher risk for dental cavities than does a diet with hard, abrasive foodstuffs, because the sticky starch is more likely to remain on the teeth and provide nutrition to the bacteria that cause dental caries. Nowadays, with advances in modern dentistry, we have no real concept of how serious dental cavities could be. In early societies before modern dentistry and dental hygiene practices, dental disease was devastatingly painful. If the infection spread, teeth would have been lost, and infection in the gums could have spread to the whole body and become fatal. And did I mention it was devastatingly painful? Furthermore, a sedentary life, one of the essential aspects of agriculture, leads to vulnerability to infectious diseases. As humans became bound to the land, they could not easily leave a place, even if a disease with a high mortality rate was spreading. Furthermore, living close to one another meant that once one person contracted an infectious disease, it was likely only a matter of time before the whole village would succumb to the illness, and it would spread to nearby villages. When humans were nomadic, infectious diseases would be quickly left behind when we moved. Community life had other implications for disease beyond simply rapid transmission. Pathogens suddenly lived in a rich environment where new hosts were supplied almost infinitely, house after house. The result was an evolutionary change in the pathogens themselves. They could afford to be more virulent and deadly. Before human societies became sedentary, virulence was not beneficial for pathogens. To survive in a highly mobile human population, pathogens had to live with their hosts for a long time to ensure that they wouldn't be trapped in a host body that suddenly died. Thus, human-borne pathogens were evolutionarily selected for weak virulence, and infected humans survived for a relatively long time. But in this new, settled society environment, when a host died, a new one nearby could immediately take its place, over and over again. Pathogens could afford to be strongly virulent. They could afford to kill their hosts. Now consider the addition of domesticated animals, which were likewise subject to this sedentary lifestyle. Diseases of animal origin began to evolve trans-species strains, also called zoonoses, that could jump to human hosts. Humans soon were succumbing to attacks by a new breed of formidable diseases. Population explosion. Boon or bane? Judging by the narrative up until now, we might expect a substantial decrease in population to have accompanied the onset of agriculture. But a strange thing happened. Human populations increased, almost explosively. Even more surprisingly, this increase was not due to a decrease in mortality. Mortality actually increased with the rise of agriculture because of the increase in mortality-contributing factors, such as infectious diseases. The population explosion was due not to a decrease in deaths, but rather to a large increase in births. In other words, fertility far surpassed mortality. And we have agriculture to thank for that. While humans were foraging and mobile, the interbirth interval, spacing between siblings, was approximately 4 to 5 years. It would be more manageable for the mother to have her next baby after the older one could walk about and eat on its own. It is extremely difficult to raise two babies who need to be carried and cared for all the time. You might be wondering how humans could control interbirth intervals without the benefit of modern medicine and contraception. Interbirth intervals in nature often rely on the weaning period. Females do not ovulate during intensive breastfeeding because the hormone in charge of lactation suppresses ovulation, a phenomenon known as lactational amenorrhea. Once a baby is weaned and the lactational hormone decreases because breast milk is no longer needed, the female body resumes ovulation and menstrual cycling. Non-agricultural ethnographic populations often breastfeed for 3 to 4 years, after which another pregnancy occurs. This pattern results in an interbirth interval of 4 to 5 years. With a new farm-based diet relying on grains and starches, however, everything changed. Babies could be given new weaning foods, cereal and gruel, instead of their mother's breast milk. As a result, the baby could be weaned and leave the mother's care much earlier, and the mother's body could then prepare to have another baby. Now a woman could raise babies with an interbirth interval of just 2 years. As fertility increased substantially, the population grew rapidly. In evolutionary biology, population increase in a species is a mark of its successful biological adaptation. Clearly, this success was thanks to a sedentary lifestyle, agriculture, and cooking. Does our population explosion show that agriculture was ultimately an unmitigated successful evolutionary adaptation? Not quite. Rapidly increasing populations led to yet another tragedy. More farmland became necessary to feed larger populations. As a result, humans started to engage in small and then large-scale wars to take control of more land. Wars increased mortality. As mortality increased, there were fewer and fewer people to send off to war and also to work the land. The need for more children continued to rise. Now, women's lives consisted of having to have another baby while an older baby was still very young, all while working hard to plow the land. As population and productivity increased, surplus was generated. Divisions arose in which a segment of people controlled the distribution of surplus, and the distribution power was inherited through family lines. Agricultural society became stratified with a highly complex and detailed class system. Cities, nation-states, and civilization ensued. But we still have this question. With agriculture, did we step closer to prosperity or farther away? The late George Armalagos, an anthropologist at Emory University, is famous for posing this question. And the quote often attributed to him, "Agriculture is the biggest mistake in human history," probably has some merit. Farming's genetic gift. Contrary to what we commonly understand, agriculture was not solely a blessing to humanity. But it was not all bad news either. Genetics, in particular, has revealed a new reason for us to appreciate the hitherto hidden contribution of agriculture: genetic diversity. Thanks to agriculture, population expansion triggered many more opportunities for genetic mutations to occur within the population, increasing our genetic diversity. Along with human population, the raw material for evolution also explosively increased. Usually the word mutation has a negative connotation, but mutations are an integral part of evolution. The modern definition of evolutionary success rests on the idea of increased reproductive fitness, of making as many genetic copies as possible, in the form of offspring. Mutations in genes, which often occur during the copying process, may lead to different traits. If these new traits give the organism an evolutionary advantage, they are passed on, along with the rest of the organism's genetic material, at a higher rate than that of organisms without the new traits. The species will have a higher frequency of the advantageous new traits through this process, called natural selection. As such, mutation brings variation in traits and becomes the raw material for evolution. More opportunities for mutation means more opportunities for evolutionary success. Mutations occur randomly. Let's say a mutation occurs with a rate of 1 in 1,000 genes. Then there will be 10 mutations in every 10,000 genes, 1,000 in every million, and so on. As the human population exploded with agriculture, mutations also increased, leading to an explosion in genetic diversity. We can trace most of the great diversity that we see in humans today back to agriculture. The role of agriculture in increasing genetic diversity is a significant event in human history, not only for its contribution to our evolutionary success, but also because it is a case in which civilization directly influenced human evolution. For a long time, we thought that evolution stopped when culture and civilization developed. Agriculture shows that culture and civilization can have direct and dynamic effects on human evolution via population explosion. Refer to Chapter 22. Nowadays, as discussed in the previous chapter, humanity is confronting yet another cultural phenomenon for the first time in history, the increased longevity of the elderly. If culture directly influences human evolution, this older population will surely lead us in a new evolutionary direction. How will humanity respond to this new phenomenon? Chapter 10. Peking Man and the Yakuza. In the fall of 2009, I visited Beijing, China. I was invited to a conference commemorating the 80th anniversary of the discovery of Peking Man. When the conference was over, I had the opportunity to visit the famous site of Peking Man's discovery, Zhoukou Dian, a cave southwest of Beijing. As I explored the cave, I was awestruck, not just because it was a site of utmost importance in the history of paleoanthropology, but also because it reminded me of a strange email I had received 10 years before. An invitation to go on a ride-along with the notorious crime organization of Japan, the Yakuza. At the time, I was a postdoctoral researcher at a genetics institution in Hayama, Japan, south of Tokyo. The stranger who sent the email introduced himself as a journalist who had followed the Yakuza all his life. He went on to explain that the following week there was going to be an initiation rite for the Yakuza, and he would like me to accompany him to the event. At first, I was baffled by the idea that a paleoanthropologist was needed at a Yakuza initiation ceremony. As I read further, however, the situation became clear. The journalist had received a tip that the original fossil of Peking Man was supposedly going to appear at this secret initiation rite, and he wanted an expert with him to assess whether it was the real, original Peking Man fossil. My curiosity was piqued. If the claim was legitimate, it would be a truly rare moment in the history of paleoanthropology. It would also be a chance to solve a decades-old cold case. The famous Peking Man fossil had been missing since World War II. The Peking Man Mystery. Peking Man was discovered in Zhoukou Dian, China, in the 1920s. The find consisted of numerous fossils, including several partial crania, mandibles, numerous teeth, and some postcranial, below-the-neck, skeletal bones. They are historically significant, along with the Java Man fossils discovered in Indonesia at the end of the 19th century, as the earliest evidence of hominin presence in East Asia. The excavation started with a single molar and continued until 1937, when the Japanese invasion of China interrupted the work. In 1941, the fossils were taken to the Qinhuangdao Harbor, in Bohai Bay, east of Beijing, in preparation for transport to the United States, where it was hoped they could be safely stored until the end of the war. That was the last time they were seen. They vanished from the harbor without a trace. Ever since, paleoanthropologists have been searching for the original Peking man fossils. Several hypotheses have been proposed as to their location. Some have argued that the CIA has them. Others have claimed China has them. There was great excitement in China in 2012 when a newspaper published an account from a witness